This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Mark hasn't bothered to come back to the studio yet.
Oh, here he comes.
Anytime you like. So what's the latest sport then, Vassos, apart from those stories that you've got? Anything breaking at the moment?
Scotland are going to finish their World Cup qualifying campaign with a match at home to Holland, which could be a good game.
Excellent. Thank you for bringing us that last... That was an ad-lib, was it? You just made that up?
No, I didn't. I mean, it's not. It's true.
Yes.
But I did just... So I didn't make it up, but it was an ad-lib.
Fill the gap nicely.
Yes. Yeah.
Because, Mark...
Thank you.
Where were you?
What, you mean after I went out to get your coffee that I then brought in to have to go out and get my own piece of paper, but I couldn't have done it earlier because I was getting your coffee, and I couldn't get your coffee before because I was helping you out with the Ang Lee interview, and I couldn't get it before that because I was helping you out with the Jimmy Carr interview. But other than that, Simon, no, you just carry on.
I think you'll have noticed I didn't.
This is like it's like when people come home from work, right? People come home from work and they say to their, you know, people at home, they say, "What have you been doing all day?" Well, nothing. Looking after the kids, running the house, doing the shopping, all the stuff. It's unseen housework. That's what it is.
Good luck.
I am the housewife of this radio station.
Tom, thanks very much indeed. Who rattled your cage?
You did. You said any time you like after I've been running around picking our kids up from school.
I was blissfully unaware I needed any help with Jimmy Carr interview, but thanks for popping in anyway. Michael in Farnborough finally got round to watching Capote this week. Is it me or were the two Marks, Kermode and Pellegrino, separated at birth? Also, where did Mark find the barking Christmas card from the special the two of you did last Christmas and New Year?
Where did what?
The barking Christmas card that you did on... We had it on the Christmas New Year special.
Oh, fine. So I brought it in and it barked.
I've waited all year to buy one for my wife. I can't find it anywhere.
Somebody sent it to me. There's quite a lot of cards nowadays that do things when you open them. Most depressingly, there's things like Elvis cards, but they're all unlicensed. They're all like an Elvis... So they're not actually allowed to say Elvis on them. You know, so there's like a drawing
of
somebody...
Why is that a problem?
Well, because I like to buy licensed Elvis stuff. I like to feel that Priscilla's getting a little bit of a kickback from it if I...
Because she needs it.
Does she? Well, you know, she has an empire to maintain, and now that Michael Jackson's out of the picture, it's important.
Anyway, Mark, if Mark does remember where he bought it, you mentioned it during the review so I can pick up the info from the podcast.
I don't, but if it was anywhere, it would have been Londy's in Brockenhurst, so believe me, you're going to have to go a long way.
I'm told it might have been Tesco's, actually.
Tesco's. They were Tesco's, yeah, that's probably right.
Michael,
other stores are available.
It's quite difficult to find a Tesco, isn't it? It's a very small specialist store, only available in small parts of the country.
Didn't the latest survey say something like one in every £2 spent?
Rory in Dublin, following on from Mark's Christmas movie list, I'd just like to add that I reckon John McClane's quote on a dead terrorist to Gruber in Die Hard is an all-time classic Christmas quote. Now I have a machine gun.
Yes, ho, ho, ho.
By the way, about Blade Runner, I like the voiceover version. Maybe that's because it was the first one that I watched. On that subject...
There's a lot of people who do like it, actually. There's a strangely nostalgic charm.
Justin Hancock saw Blade Runner for the first... By the way, our new Christmas show, just recorded, is available on Christmas Day. Sort of about midday, I think it is. It was quite good.
How were we? Were we quite good?
I think we were quite good.
Isn't it sort of shattering the illusion of it being live?
I don't think anyone believed that last time, did they?
No, because I had the cold that I had at the end of November last year.
Justin says, I saw Blade Runner for the first time at Mark's favourite cinema, The Phoenix in East Finchley, on Saturday. When it ended, I turned to my wife and whispered that I thought it was a bit boring. I said it could have done with an exploding helicopter or two. She and Wikipedia convinced me that actually it was a film noir existential classic. I do now genuinely like the film, but I was expecting helicopters or sword fighting, or at the very least... some running. So my question is...
Well, there is some running.
Why is it called Blade Runner?
Well, Zora dies running through a glass, plate glass window. Why is it called Blade Runner?
That indeed was the question.
Oh, that's... Well, of course, you know it's based on Android's Dream of Electric Sheep, and for a long time it was going to be called Dangerous Days, and I think Blade Runner ended up getting the title because he says he is a Blade Runner, and it is one of those things that clearly the studio thought that was a sexier title than Dangerous Days, although for a long time it was Dangerous Days. Incidentally, Catherine Haber, who was at one point Sam Peckinpah's Girl Friday, but ended up working on Blade Runner, who we interviewed for our documentary about Blade Runner several years ago, said, as far as the voiceover was concerned, the Harrison Ford voiceover, that the whole thing came down to nobody wanted the voiceover, and the producers wanted a voiceover because they didn't think anybody understood the movie. And they said to Harrison Ford, look, just come in and do it. And, you know, no one's going to use it, but it'll humour them. And she said, and he did it really badly so they wouldn't use it, and then they did.
Reviews coming up. Looks like a holiday season with Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium, a B-movie, Enchanted, We Own the Night, Youth Without Youth. We'll try and get to as many of those as possible before four. Your comments welcome. Box office top 10 this week at 10. Arjun Achli.
Again, calling for reviews because not national press gents. I assume that that'll be Aya. But I don't know. I'm not good at pronunciation.
Number 9, the Darjeeling Limited.
Neither are new. You say controversy, which is just nonsense.
Number 9, the Darjeeling Limited.
Wes Anderson slips, gets smug, nothing like as funny or as insightful as it thinks it is.
Number 8, the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford.
You know, people are stopping me in the streets, or more importantly, in Waterloo. No, they are. I mean, just out there, I was in Waterloo.
You mean out there just where you were?
No, but I was in...
your desk, people are stopping you.
By my desk, people are stopping me. I was in Waterloo Station yesterday, and somebody walked up to me, and they shook my hand, and they said, you're absolutely right about the assassination of Jesse James. And I felt like hugging them. I felt like saying, you know, I've had so many people come up to me and saying, what are you talking about? It's so boring. You know, that's not a Western. Bloody, bloody, bloody. I mean, I have now seen it twice. I know now that I am absolutely right about it. It's been sort of shamefully overlooked in the Golden Globes, although because there is a nomination for Casey Affleck. The more you tell me that I'm wrong about it, you know it's just a kind of, it's digging my heels in.
I haven't told you you're wrong about it at all. It's the listener.
I'm addressing the listener. I'm looking at you because you're there, but I'm addressing the listener. The more one tells me...
I'm just the conduit for your wrath.
Yeah, but I'm totally right about this. I'm totally right about it. And if you see The Assassination of Jesse James and it doesn't work for you, the fault's yours, not the film's. Sorry.
Ratatouille at 7.
Yeah, nominated in the Golden Globes as Best Animated Film, along with B-Movie and The Simpsons Movie. I mean, I think that tells us something about the animation standard this year. I mean, I did enjoy The Simpsons Movie, but... that's not a great brace of animated movies, is it?
Stardust at 6.
Which is still hanging on in there in its clunky, strange old way. And not a bad little, very British, rough-around-the-edges movie it is, too.
Beowulf at 5.
Yeah. What you're now going for?
Beowulf.
Not Beowulf.
No, Beowulf.
Yeah, I am Beowulf. Ray Winstone running. Still can't get over the fact that there's an entire sequence in which he fights in the buff. Still can't get over the fact that it's a 12-certificate film. If you're going to see it, however, attempt to see it in the IMAX 3D version. There are actually now quite a lot of IMAX cinemas scattered around the country, and although I'm not a huge fan of anything other than your standard format cinema, if you're going to see Beowulf, you might as well get the full nutso in your face version, because I suspect that if you just see it in the flat screen, it, you know, the faults, which are many, are more apparent.
American Gangster is number 4.
Which has done very well at the Golden Globes. I like it. Real return to form for Ridley Scott. I think, despite the fact that it refers to the French Connection, it still manages to hold its own and find its own feet. And good, solid performances by Denzel Washington. And Russell Crowe, who I saw from a news story today, has recently been cited as one of the least good value actors in terms of how much they pay him and how much his movies make in return.
Hitman is number 3.
Video games, stay out of my cinema.
Fred Claus at number 2.
Fred Claus, stay out of my cinema. It's horrible, horrible, horrible film.
Golden Compass at number 1. Letter on that subject from Steve. Having seen the Golden Compass this week, thought I'd listen again to last week's review just to see how it fits in with what I thought. On the whole, I have to agree with the Bad Doctor, but I'm a bit confused as to what he says and what I've read in several other reviews with regards to one point. I seem to be one of the few people, haven't read the books, haven't seen the stage version. As a result, I was slightly worried I might not understand it. But rather than have no idea what was happening, I entirely understood everything that was happening. I didn't think there was much to understand. So, and then he puts colon, some sinister faceless characters are kidnapping vulnerable children, and one girl who was given a magic tool goes to try and save them. She's helped out on her journey by a number of different slightly oddball characters and frees the children from their captors. It's clearly going to be a second, if not a third installment, where she'll have to save Lord Asriel and no doubt face Mrs. Coulter again sometime. Can't see what's so difficult to understand. Undoubtedly there is more going on in the source material, but simply judging the film by itself, I can't see what's not to understand.
Okay, I'm very impressed that you managed to glean that from the film, because I've seen the play and I saw the film, I didn't understand what was going on. It seemed to me that there was an awful lot of, I mean, actually, what you've just said is a perfect sort of sight and sound style plot synopsis. You would be a fantastic police witness. If somebody said to you, would you please stand up and repeat what had happened? That is exactly what they want, and you clearly have a very analytical mind. However, go on.
Apart from the key thing, which is dust.
Which isn't there.
It is, but no, it's the whole plot thing, which is not mentioned by Steve.
Exactly, because that's in fact, in a way, that's exactly the point. That what you get is the stuff, the nuts and bolts, but what you don't get is the whole picture. You don't get the machine. You see the cogs and the screws and whiz, but you don't see the time. Crucially, you come out of the Golden Compass with, you know, even if you understood on that level, you know, the plotting, the mechanics of the plotting, which I have to say I didn't, what you don't get is the substance. You don't get the stuff about Original Sin. You don't get the stuff about the...
I think that all emerges over a period of time. But anyway, the dust is...
Well, do you think it emerges in the Golden Compass, in the film? Have you seen the Golden Compass?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I saw it last weekend, and I think there's enough in there for you to go, what was all that?
What was all that about?
So you end up, you've gone to see a kid's film, and you end up having a theological conversation on the way home, and I think that's a plus point. The other main plus point is the girl who plays Lyra
is great.
Is absolutely brilliant. And however they found her, it's a work of genius, because she's really tough, she's really gutsy, but she's vulnerable when she needs to be.
Yeah. No, hers is a really good performance. Have you seen in the news that the Catholic League are claiming a moral victory against the film because they demanded a boycott of it at the American box office on the grounds that it was heretically anti-religious and specifically anti-Catholic, and it underperformed and then some in America. It's performed better in Europe. So they are now running around saying, you know, yay, 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 we trounced the great demon and somehow undid its satanic powers. If there is one thing that makes me like the Golden Compass more, it's the fact that nutballs like that are out picketing it. Because I have to say, whatever your religious persuasion, anyone who thinks that the Golden Compass is in somehow bad, evil, and spreading the word of the devil and undoing it is an idiot.
Yes, and I would pitch into that. If you are a very religious person and you go and see that movie, and your religion is represented by the kind of people who are in the magisterium, then you've got a problem.
Yeah, go and see Ken Russell's The Devils. That's the film that you're looking for.
So I'm looking forward, and I hope that there are volumes 2 and 3.
Well, there was apparently some... I mean, obviously, everyone's a little bit on the back foot now because it has underperformed. I mean, clearly, they have started filming number 2 because there's a whole section at the end of the first one that is now going to appear in some compressed form in the second one. They can't stop. But it's, you know, it has not done what they wanted it to do. And of course, the American box office being what it is now, it's like by 5 o'clock on Friday, they've kind of done the maths and given up.
I think this is Christy, who's in Los Alamos in New Mexico. Last week, Mark went on and on about the Golden Compass, the play.
Did I go on and on? Oh, the play, sorry. Yeah.
Yes, you did.
Did I? I thought I was quite rational about it.
You were rational, but you went on. That's just a length thing, but it was fine.
Okay.
Don't be upset. You okay?
No, I'm fine. Slightly harsh words.
I highly recommend listening to the Golden Compass audiobook, says Christy.
Oh, right, okay.
The US version is narrated by Philip Pullman and supported by a full cast. It's brilliant. Other than the US version of the Harry Potter books read by Jim Dale, the Golden Compass and his other Dark Materials books are my favourite audiobooks ever. Anyway, thank you.
The best audiobooks ever.
Have we had any New Mexican listeners?
No, well, hello to the whole of New Mexico. The best audiobooks ever are the Harry Potter books as read by Stephen Fry, which are just, I mean...
vastly entertaining.
They are wonderful. I mean, nobody reads a text like Stephen Fry, and that is a wonderful thing.
3:17, Louise, with some travel and reviews coming. Do we start with B-movie, or where are we
going to
start?
Yeah, we will, yeah. Because what we'll do is... because we need to get through... because as you know, Christmas is coming, so we're going to get through B-Movie, Enchanted, and Mr. McGill's Emporium, definitely. And then for the grown-ups, we're going to do the new Francis Ford Coppola movie. And then if we have time, we'll get onto We Own the Night. I actually would like to say something about It's a Wonderful Life, because that's been re-released, but I have said everything about It's a Wonderful Life a million times before. But I was on stage last night with the Coen brothers, and we brought up It's a Wonderful Life, and it turns out that we completely agree, so that's great. They
How
think
reassuring.
It's about suicide as well.
Nida O'Leary, just so Mark feels better, says Nida. He's completely and absolutely and utterly right about the assassination of Jesse James.
Hey!
Blah, blah, blah. Of course, he's wrong about Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Lost in Translation, History of Violence, and the last bomb movie, but nobody's perfect. Watching the webcam, says Marcus, Simon should really stop pointing aggressively at Mark.
Yeah, thank you.
I'll do that.
Yeah.
Because we are being live-streamed, should you want to check this out. Carl on this email, could you please ask Mark to stop playing to the camera? He keeps glancing over with a weird smile, and it's scary.
What? I don't. That's the clock. Okay, let me look. Look there. That's the camera. That's the clock.
Classic radio. Carl in Belfast. Could you thank the good doctor for his great Q&A in Belfast a few weeks ago before the screening of Silent Running?
Hey.
It's great to see in the flesh all the vitriolic glory as he explained why we shouldn't watch Pirates. It was also most enlightening to finally hear the Harvey Keitel story. You never told
no,
that.
No, there isn't.
You never on
no,
a stage.
No, I didn't. I absolutely didn't.
Well, what's Carl in Belfast referring to then?
That I didn't. It's an ironic thing.
Just never try that.
No. Anyway, for the record,
Jimmy Carr.
No, I'm not. I'm not going anywhere near this. There's a, you know, as everyone knows, not true urban myth. Anyway,
but if you bump into him on Waterloo Station,
if you bump into him in Waterloo, I'm going to say the same thing. And definitively, if you want to check it out, there is stuff on the IMDb. Totally untrue. Absolutely urban myth. 100% not true. Never happened. End of story.
If you'd like to know what the B-movie was like, here's Mark Kermode's entertaining review.
I went to see Mr. McGorham's Wonder Emporium this morning. And
are
there
we
was,
doing it in the wrong order?
No, I'm not. This is going to get there. And there was a trailer for B-movie, which I'd already seen. And the trailer was Jerry Seinfeld dressed up as a bee, hanging down on a piece of string. And he says, I can't act being a bee. I can't act being a bee. I can't act being a bee. And then Steven Spielberg comes on and says, hey, you know what? Why don't you just do it as a cartoon? And I had that sort of feeling when I was watching B-movie. So the story is that apparently Jerry Seinfeld said to Spielberg, you know, I got this idea to make a film about a bee. And they said, okay, great. And the next day they got in touch and said, yeah, I want to do the movie about the bee. And then he had to sit down and actually write the damn thing. So we have him voicing a bee who wants to be more than just a drone. And therefore he goes out of the hive and he meets a woman who is played by Renee Zellweger. And he starts talking to the woman because it turns out that bees can talk. And then the bees find out that humans are eating honey. And then he decides to sue the human race. Let's hear a clip.
This is worse than anything the bears have done to us, and I intend to do something about it.
Oh, Barry, stop.
Who told you that humans are taking our honey? That's just a rumor.
Do these look like rumors?
That's a conspiracy theory. These are obviously doctored photos.
Ugh. Barry, how did you get mixed up in all this?
Because he's been talking to humans.
What?
Talking to humans?
He has a human girlfriend.
Oh, Barry.
And they make out.
Make out? Barry.
We do not.
You wish you could.
Whose side are you on?
The bees.
I dated a cricket once in San Antonio. Man, those crazy legs kept me up all night. At Chihuahua.
Barry, this is what you want to do with your life?
This is what I want to do for all our lives. Nobody works harder than bees. What right do they have to our hard-earned honey? We're living on 2 cups a year. They're putting it in lip balm for no reason whatsoever.
Even if it's true, Barry, what could one bee do?
I'm going to sting them where it really hurts.
Now, according to the BBFC, use certificate contains no material likely to offend or harm, but only after a cut of 20 seconds, a compulsory cut, which was required because the film, which is aimed at younger viewers, showed a potentially dangerous and easily imitated technique involving materials that are readily available in the average household, specifically turning household items into a flamethrower. Now, I just checked this with the BBFC. Do you remember the James Bond movie?
Which one? The last
Live and
one?
Let Die. Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die. It's either Live and Let Die.
It's
either
Me too. It's either Live and Let. We're made for each other. It's either Live and Let Die, The Man with the Golden Gun. I'm sure it's Live and Let Die, in which he's in a bathroom. A snake comes into the bathroom. He's doing some stuff with a shaving foam. He gets his light. He goes, flamethrower, off. And I remember seeing that thinking, is that true? Because it's nonsense and, you know, bloody, bloody, blah. But anyway, the BBFC have apparently become much more concerned about that sort of thing since then. Although that movie went through uncut at, well, then A, now PG, for a U certificate, and in fact for any certificate shy of 18, they would have had to remove the easily imitatable use of apparently imitatable flamethrower.
It's a cartoon, though.
Yeah, I know, but it's an instructional thing. I just mentioned that as a... Now, and the reason I mention it is it's one of the most interesting things about B-movie, which otherwise is not very interesting at all. Several problems with it, and they go something like this. Firstly, it has no proper sense of its anthropomorphism. Okay,
the way just that, run that sentence again.
It has no proper sense of its anthropomorphism.
Thank
right,
you.
The way in which you do movies about animals talking to each other is the animals talk to each other. Okay, you don't then cross over the species boundary and have the animals then talking to the humans. And the gag is that the animals talk. Right, when we're in the hive with all the animals talking to each other, it's fine. We're in animal world, we're in fantasy world. But there's a plot point here, which is that he meets a woman, then he starts talking to her, and she goes, "Blimey, a talking bee." So the gag isn't that bees live their life in relation to humans. The gag is that all bees actually talk, which means that none of the rest suggest the movie makes any sense, because bees don't wear hats, bees don't fly, bees don't you know, drive cars. None of these things happen. So you've trodden over the line. You've broken the unwritten rule of this. You can't do that. It's like
you can do.
No, you can't. It's like
it's made up. It's not true.
No, it doesn't work. It does. No, there are rules that doesn't work if you do that. In the same way as it doesn't work in Ocean's blah, 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 when Julia Roberts manages to get into a club because she looks like Julia Roberts, but nobody says, yeah, but he looks like Brad Pitt and he looks like George Clooney and that other guy looks like Casey Affleck, and anyway there's a whole movie crew around it. There's ways of doing anthropomorphism, and that ain't one of them. Number one. Number two, it's a comedy about lawyers. It's a comedy in which a bee sues the human race, right? Well, very funny for the, you know, the grown-ups and all the rest of it. What kids go, what, sue? What does sue mean? I don't know. Isn't sue, you know, a boy called Sue?
Because they'll go straight away with that Johnny Cash reference, won't they?
Well, they're more likely to do that than say, oh yes, I understand it's a legal term. So,
no, I don't think so.
Point number two,
they're more likely to get the legal term than they are the Johnny Cash reference.
Point number three, the whole thing about I don't want to be a drone is ripped off of Ants, which in itself was kind of ripped off of A Bug's Life, and that, you know, that's all been done before. Point number four, the jokes aren't as funny as they ought to be, and that's not to say that I didn't laugh a few times, but when I did laugh, I laughed as an adult laughing at adult humour, not adult and the in the, you know, X-rated
Jimmy Carr sense,
in the Jimmy Carr sense, but adult as in the, so it's almost like you've gone through the looking glass. The cartoon is no longer being made for the kids' audience. It's being made as a sort of, you know, I want to make gags that will make sense to the older audience, and I've kind of completely bypassed the kids. Oh, bother, you know what, I've got to do something for the kids, let's do it as a cartoon. And this all kind of came into focus for me when I saw that trailer, and the trailer was, the gag is, he's Jerry Seinfeld dressed up as a bee, he can't do the dressing up as a bee, so Steven Spielberg says, and incidentally not very convincing, because Steven Spielberg may be a director, but boy, he can't act his way out of a paper bag, says, why don't you just do it as a cartoon? And you know what, there's a terrible sense of that. There's a terrible sense of that's what they've done. They've just gone, why not do it as a cartoon? It's not terrible, but it ain't a kid's film. Or it's not a proper kid's film, because if it is a proper kid's film, it doesn't do, the anthropomorphism thing doesn't work, the animation should be funny, the story should be better, and the jokes should be better, and then none of those are true.
If you had to choose between B-movie and Alvin and the Chipmunks.
I haven't seen Alvin and the Chipmunks yet. I'm seeing it next week. I saw the trailer for it. Looked gruesome, but hey, you never know. So very quickly, before we get to the half past thing, also this...
The half past thing being the news and sport, is it?
That'll be me.
Yeah, I didn't mean...
That's Tom. Tom has just come in, and he's the half-past thing.
Tom, I didn't mean you as the half-past thing. Well, I mean,
I just call you half.
Now I can't look at the clock, because I look at the clock, we get emails from listeners saying, stop looking at the
camera. Mugging to the camera.
I'm not, it's a clock. Put the cameras over there, right? Or put the clock somewhere else.
Are we going to do Mr. Magorium, or are we going to wait?
Have we got time?
Yes, well,
fine.
Mr. half-past thing.
Mr. Magorium.
What were you going to do?
I was going to do Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium before you sort of, you know, sidetracked me. Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium, or... Or, also known as, you know, I really wish I'd made Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory,
Charlie Chonker is a good one.
But sadly, I couldn't
That's your fault, Tom.
So the story is, Dustin Hoffman is not Willy Wonka, he's Mr. Magorium, and he has a magical emporium, which is a magical toy shop, and it's sort of run by Natalie Portman, and he's 100 and blah years old, which incidentally will come back to haunt us when we get to the Francis Ford Coppola movie, but he's decided that he's probably had enough and he may want to check out, and anyway, here's a clip.
Wait, what departure?
It was intended to be a spectacular surprise, but it appears the store has other intents. That's one of my favorites, Christine.
Wait, what was meant as a surprise?
I'm giving you the store.
You're giving me the store?
Surprise! Surprise! Surprise!
Okay, seriously, sir.
What, Mahoney?
I can't take the Emporium.
But you told me you needed a new occupation.
I meant writing music, not running the Emporium.
Why not? You do a splendid job of it.
So, it's written and directed by the guy who wrote Stranger Than Fiction, with which it shares an awful lot of things. It's got, you know, uptight accountant sent in to sort out shop. Shop's got a bunch of magical stuff going on. Uptight accountant can't deal with the magic, falls in love with the strangely kooky girl who wins him over with cookies and blah blah blah. Dustin Hoffman's performance is incredibly gurning. It's one of those mad hair, strange teeth, bit of a lisp, wobbles around, thinks that's funny. No, sorry, it won't work. And he's desperately trying to do Gene Wilder and not doing it very well. And those people who thought that Johnny Depp wasn't as good as Gene Wilder in Charlie. I mean, I actually think Johnny Depp was very good in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but you honestly, you really ought to see Dustin Hoffman trying to discover the inner child within him, which is a terrible sight to behold. You know, when Hoffman was a great, the great method acting story about Hoffman is that he turns up on set of Marathon Man. Everyone knows this story, but I'll tell it again. He turns up on set of Marathon Man. He's really, really tired. And Sir Lawton says, what's the matter? Why are you really tired? He says, well, I got a scene, you know, in this scene, I got to be really tired. So I've been up all night, so I'm really tired. And Sir Lawton says, dear boy, why don't you just act? And in this, he is acting for all he is worth. There's hair, there's teeth, there's lisping, there's falling over, there's clowning, there's goofing, there's girding. There's an awful lot of stuff in this film in which people have clearly been told, laugh hysterically, laugh magically, react as if you're reacting to something completely magical. There's a sequence in it in which Natalie Portman takes him out for a crazy day, and she says, what are we going to do? And he says, we're going to do something really reckless and crazy and young. And they go to a bed shop and they bounce on the beds, which is crazy, and they laugh. And then they go to a park and they put down bubble wrap and they dance on the bubble wrap, and it goes pop in the way that bubble wrap doesn't if you stand on it. Actually, you have to do it with your fingers. It doesn't if you spread the weight out. That's why the Titanic floated until it hit the iceberg. Yeah, if you spread the weight out, it doesn't. No, it's important.
Oh, right.
And so there's an awful lot of girding, an awful lot of enforced hilarity, an awful lot of, and then there's suddenly author's message, and the author's message is, you know what, everyone dies. Death is not a bad thing.
Well, in the film,
yeah. Not everyone in the film dies. The author's message is everyone dies.
Imagine that. It's a kid's film with Dustin Hoffman, Mr. Magorium's magical thing, and then
everyone dies.
Every single person dies before the
end of the
film. The
message of the film is everyone
dies. It's 633 Squadron all over again.
And they don't all die in 633 Squadron.
Most of them.
Do they?
Yeah.
Okay. And then Dustin Hoffman gives
Titanic all over
this
again.
Titanic, yeah. And Dustin Hoffman gives this big speech about, you know what, I had a great life, I just want you to remember the life, I don't remember all the nice bits, and then some swirly stuff happens. And it made me think, I need to see Bridge to Terabithia again, because the more I think about Bridge to Terabithia, the more I think that I probably did misjudge it. The more I think that actually, in terms of it addressing the subject of mortality, it did a better job than Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium. Once again, it's just flat and lacking in magic and not worthy of the subject which it attempts to address. And you think, I don't want to palm my kids off on this, really. You know, it's just, it's not good enough.
Bridge to Terabithia, then we add that to the list of things you might have got wrong.
Increasingly long.
This is Five Life. If you remember, a couple of weeks ago, we asked you to vote for your favourite 10 Christmas films as chosen by Mark. It was a little bit of altercation, a little bit of a conversation, a little bit of a rearrangement. You can watch us count down the top 10 from 4 o'clock this afternoon on the website at bbc.co.uk/5live. The whole thing goes live, though recorded.
Yes.
But it goes live.
It goes live,
in a recorded
kind
of way at 4 o'clock. Here's a little taste of what's on offer.
Die Hard's at number 3. This is 11.2%.
Where are my detonators? Once again, proving that Christmas movies don't have to be about nice, jolly, lovely things. They can be about lunatic terrorists taking over an incredibly large tower block. Exactly. That's it. It's just the setting.
It's an 18. I've got a DVD of this, and it's an 18, and purely for language, and now it would only get a 15.
Is that right?
Yeah, there's a lot of melon farmers. That's why it's an 18.
There's a lot of quite severe violence.
It's,
but there's bullets and kneecaps interfacing in a way that I think would still get it an 18.
It's melon farmers, and I think in those ancient days, melon farmers got
yippee-ki-yay melon farmer. I think that still gets you an 18. I think that what is referred to as the Oedipal expletive still gets you an 18 certificate. But it's terrific, and it has the definitive Bruce Willis in a vest performance, and of course this year we saw Die Hard 4-pointless, which demonstrates that even after all these years of being a huge movie star and making Pulp Fiction, doing all the rest of it, Bruce knows where his core audience lies, and it is the vest. Although, of course, in the new movie, he doesn't wear a vest; it's a singlet because he's getting on a little bit. And he still looks better than I do. But you know.
Is it one of those kind of Playtex girdles that holds it in when you press?
That's
it
the
in.
William Shatner effect.
Right?
No.
So that's number 3. At number 2 is a fine movie, The Muppet Christmas Carol. 20.5% of people are saying that's the best.
See, people just love The Muppets. And I think it's a funny thing that everyone sort of says it ironically. And we put The Muppet Christmas Carol in sort of vaguely as a last-minute thought, because everyone, when we were doing the list, said, oh, you know, Muppet Christmas Carol, everyone loves Muppet Christmas Carol. It is really, you know, it is really funny. And then we put it in, and actually, it's I was funny. Surprised that it went in number two. You've seen it, right?
Yeah, I think it's funny. Muppet Treasure Island was good as well. But
yeah, Muppet Treasure Island is great. Muppet Treasure Island is slightly more cine literate because Muppet Treasure Island has things like references to Apocalypse Now in it. Do you remember that with Gonzo waving the thing around and going, "Is he a good man? Is he a wise?" Which is Apocalypse Now, and we obviously that's going over the head of most of the Muppets audience. But it does demonstrate that the Muppets thing is timeless. That if you are a Muppets fan, because everybody went on the Muppet Show when the Muppet Show was at its height. I mean, everyone who was anyone was on the Muppet Show, and when they were really good, they were absolutely cracking. And in the end, it was the Sesame Street puppets, wasn't it? I mean, that was.
And if you started to do a Fozzie Bear impression, it was very close to John
Major.
You do
a really good Fozzie Bear. Go on.
But it's
so
Douglas.
Do it again for the podcast.
Hiya, hiya, hiya.
But that's not far from Douglas Hurd and John Major, and that was slightly disconcerting. You know?
Well, the country being run by Fozzie Bear, you know, frankly, it's you know, there could be worse things.
So the Muppet Christmas Carol is at number two, and it is not. I didn't want to puncture our particular festive balloon by making it an unsurprising sort of list,
no.
But at number one, where it's been forever, I suspect, when you ask people their favourite Christmas movie, there it is at number one, 41.6% of the votes. If you want to find out precisely what won, you have to go to bbc.co.uk/5live. You can watch us count down the top 10 Christmas movies after the programme. And if you're watching that streamed online, the most bizarre thing that was, as you were watching us listening to ourselves talking about something which will be shown later. Most peculiar.
Yeah.
You enjoy that?
I've never listened to us before.
Most peculiar. I wouldn't recommend it.
No.
Try the podcast later.
What's on Radio 2?
On the subject of anthropomorphism.
Anthropomorphism.
John on this says, in Finding Nemo, the film is only ruined by the plot point where a fish can read the address on a pair of goggles. The rest is fairly feasible.
Thank you. But
fish communicating with each other and so on. Compare this with the nonsense that is Shark's Tale,
where all
the fish live in cities, run shops and even work in a car wash. Worst offender, Pixar's Cars. For what reason do cars and roads exist if there are no people to drive
them?
Evolution wouldn't work this way unless it's a post-apocalyptic scenario where humans have been wiped out and the only artificially intelligent cars have survived. Thank you.
Cars, Cars is an exception because cars exist in an alternative world in which there are no people. The reason cars doesn't break the rule is because it doesn't go, there's no people.
These rules written down?
In the world, what do you mean, where are they written down? It's like, where's the law of gravity written down?
In a book.
Which
law of physics?
The law of physics, right. Well, this is written down in the book, The Law of Anthropomorphic.
If you could give me that
tales
for Christmas, that would be great.
I'll certainly sort it out
for
you.
Find me an entertaining movie to watch.
Get a version of it narrated by Stephen Fry, then I will get it over to you as soon as possible. Mr. McGorry's Wonder Emporium, incidentally, use certificate contains one use of mild language, the word that begins with C, ends with P, and is an anagram of carp. But also, and another use of a word that begins with J, but I love the BBFC. They say, it's used by a shop announcer who we don't see in the shop. It's clearly not aimed at anyone, and it's not used very loudly.
Oh, that's all right.
It's not just rude language, it's how loudly you say it. I love them. They are wonderful. And incidentally, it ties back to the Ang Lee thing. You have to have a good rating system, otherwise you end up with films like Lust Caution being cut for all audiences. Which brings us along to Enchanted, which I had very low hopes for because the trailer was very funny, but it looked like all the gags are in the trailer.
But on that very subject, from Martin at Old Portsmouth. He says, Enchanted. The Times critic said it made him cry. And knowing Kermode blubs like a wean at the drop of the proverbial headwear, I want to know what the Kleenex count was. And seeing that comments have been made about this film comparing it to the truly legendary Princess Bride. Hello, my name is Inigo
Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Does it stand comparison with Rob Reiner's underrated by all but the cognoscenti masterpiece?
I've got to tell you, straight away, it ain't The Princess Bride, but so little is. I mean, Princess Bride, it's like saying something isn't Spinal Tap, but so little is. So there we go. However, it's Disney taking a pop at themselves after, you know, films like Shrek have taken a pop at them, and then Shrek has gone right off the boil. So it starts out as a twee Disney cartoon with a really annoying princess, heroine, who is saved from castle falling by, you know, big jawed, lantern jawed, I think is the word, prince. They're then going to get married, but then she is thrown down a well by evil stepmother, voiced by Susan Sarandon, which rhymes with abandon, and she ends up in New York. And then the gag is that she's a Disney princess at large in New York. She meets up with Patrick Dempsey, of course. I can't believe, you know, none of these things you think are true are true. Get with the real world woman. Anyway, here's a clip.
You know, I know what it's like when someone disappoints you. It's tempting to see things the way you wish they were instead of how they are.
I don't wish that he's coming, Robert. He is.
Right. Because the chipmunk told you.
Yes. Pip actually said that.
But you know what? I don't know if you're kidding or you're being ironic, because chipmunks, they don't talk.
Well, not here they don't.
All right, so in lieu of taking advice from a forest rodent, I just wanted to say that, you know, if it did work out and you decided to stay in New York, I'd like to help.
Well, that's very kind of you, Robert. But Edward is coming for me.
But what if he doesn't?
He is coming.
Giselle, I don't think so. No.
Yes!
I have to disagree. No.
No?
No.
Is that the only word that you know? No?
No.
It's quite good.
It is. And like here's that. And look, here's the thing. So I did go in thinking it's going to be a one-note gag, and the gag isn't going to work very well. You know what? It's really charming, and it's actually pretty funny, and I did have a little bit of a blub. Not a massive blub, but I did have a blub.
When was the last time you blubbed at a kid's film? Or a family film, however you want to call it.
Well, I watched It's a Wonderful Life again recently, so, you know, that's always...
Yeah, but you wouldn't sit the kids down in front of It's a Wonderful Life.
No, well, I've had a go... You know, it's a film about darkness thrilled. And suicide. Have a look. Existential despair. Look, the angel doesn't turn up to... Anyway, fine.
It's black and white. It's really old.
Yeah, but my kids don't mind that, Simon, because they're cine-literate and smart.
Are,
thank you very much. Moving swiftly on. So, firstly, Amy Adams is great. I mean, she won everybody's hearts with Junebug, and in this she demonstrated that she is a really, really good comedian. It's a hard role to pull off an annoying Disney princess and do it in a way which is actually charming and sweet at the same time as being an annoying Disney princess, and she does it really well. Secondly, I mean, things like the sequences in which she gets to clean up the guy's house by calling in all the local rats to clean up his bathroom, which they clean his toilet with his toothbrush, are actually funny for everybody, because the fact is, you know, for me it's funny because it's a kind of a self-referential gag. For the kids, it's funny because it's toothbrushes down the toilet, which is always funny. Let's be honest about this. Thirdly, the songs by Menken and Schwartz, who did all the, you know, the Disney stuff before, like Hunchback of Notre Dame and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. I mean, you know, they're a real good songwriting pair. And I like a good show tune, as you know. And there are, but don't do that. I just like a good show tune. And I like Barbara Streisand, and that's perfectly fine.
It is perfectly fine.
And they are good show. They're done ironically, but they're nicely ironic. And they work really, really well, and they are good tunes in and of themselves. And at the end, it sort of decides to go a little bit overboard, and it kind of gets a bit Ghostbusters. And I thought, okay, they've gone for the big special effects finale. I don't know whether they're starting to lose the charm here. But then I thought, you know what? My daughter will absolutely love it. She'll really, really love it. But my little boy might think, yeah, we're girly, you know, kissing, all that sort of stuff. But it ends with a big dragon fight. So in a way, there's something for the boysy ones who like Transformers at the same time. And at the end of the movie, I went out and went into to the gents and the critic of the Daily Mail, who I know. You know, we have totally different opinions about things. He wanted Crash to be banned. I wanted Crash to be seen by everybody, you know, shown in schools, obviously.
So you had a punch up.
No. And we both stood there and went... Wasn't that great? Wasn't that just really great?
It sounds as though...
It was really lovely. And to take your kids, it's the best of the bunch, and it's a charming... I said it's not Princess Bride, but so few things are. But she's really terrific, and it's put together with love and care. And yes, it falls apart a little bit at the end, but doesn't matter, big explosive finale. But it was a real pleasant surprise.
It sounds as though the most appropriate word is the title of the film.
Enchanting.
You reckon?
It is enchanting, yes. I think in America, at some point, it was called Ella Enchanted, and that doesn't work. You can't say, well, how was the film? It was Ella Enchanted. But it is enchanting, and it is family-friendly. PG for contains mild violence. Mild peppers, fantasy violence, contains mild comic violence. The violence is okay if it's funny, and swearing is okay if you do it off screen and a bit quietly.
Very quietly.
But stuff with, you know, household implements, we're not having any of that at any certificate at all.
Pete in Totnes, Simon, love the webcam, watching the live stream. What's all the movie talk about, though? I tuned in to see Tom and Vassos in the half past thing. Well, you got the quarter two thing in just a moment with Louise, although it's never actually quarter two,
no,
is it?
Never. No, never.
Tim? And it says, whoa, whoa, just watching the webcam. And when the news started, you and Mark just ran out of the room. What's going on?
We're having a domestic and wasn't for public consumption.
Where did you go? I feel like I've been behind the magic and I've been feeling cold and a bit frightened. I don't know. I don't know what you went to do. I went to have an editorial conversation about what's happening to Coventry City.
I went to just go and check out Zach Helm because I suddenly thought, I am thinking of the same Zach Helm, aren't I? So I rushed to the internet, and I confirmed that I was talking about the same Zach Helm.
Andrew Manchester, dear Simon, where is the law of gravity written down? It's in Newton's Principia Mathematica, of course. Do you know nothing?
Duh, brain.
Oh, that's right, because you chipped in with that one. In fact, it was your question in the first place. The law of anthropomorphism in movies, however, is written only in The Good Doctor's Sad Heart.
No, it's not. It's, you know, it's, you understand what I mean about that, don't you?
Don't bring Louise into it.
I always get brought into your arguments on a Friday afternoon.
Don't bring the quarter of an hour thing into it. Is that what you No, seriously. Very briefly, right? Animals talking in movies, right?
Yeah.
So animals talk to each other in movies. That's perfectly fine.
That's not the point.
Shush!
The point is that the law of anthropomorphism is not written down anywhere.
It's
like the law of gravity.
But it's broken if they then talk to human beings and the human beings say, blimey, I didn't know animals could talk.
And that spoils it.
Thank you very much.
They talk to each other. That's perfect.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's written in common sense.
Case proven. What to wish Jason Isaacs happy Christmas, just in case he misses next week's podcast.
Give him time to reply.
Happy Christmas, Jason. And hello, Jason. And Dave Morrissey, how are you doing? Would any of the movies that we're reviewing be improved with Jason or David?
Well, Jason obviously could have had a role in Enchanted. He actually probably could have played the Handsome Prince. I've always felt that was the role for which he was cut out. And David Morrissey would have brought a heavyweight presence, perhaps, that was lacking in B-movie. He should have been in Youth Without Youth, which you're about to move on to.
He'd have been better than Dustin Hoffman, though, wouldn't he?
Yeah. Anyone would have been better than Dustin Hoffman.
Before we leave Enchanted, Susan in Air says, you mentioned the PG certificate that Enchanted has got.
Would
the good doctor recommend it for a five-year-old? So there'd be a number of people thinking, I might want this Christmas holiday to have a first movie experience with it. Obviously, very important to get the right movie. But then think, first movie can't be a PG, can it?
Here's the thing. It may be that a five-year-old might not find... Because the jokes are... They're verbal. I mean, I think it's more a sort of seven- or eight-year-old. And it's possible that a five-year-old could be scared by the big dragony fighty thing at the end. But, as you know and as the BBFC know... Why can I hear music in my headphones? I can hear music.
I heard it as well.
Yes, you did. I see, we are both inside each other's heads. I think, as the BBFC know, in the end, only a parent of an individual child can judge what their child is ready for. I'm not saying that nobody would be scared by it. And God bless them, the BBFC do say, when it says U certificate, they say check carefully before taking very young children, except for the B movie, which says contains nothing likely to offend anyone ever. But it's, it's pants. It may be slightly above her head. I would start with the U certificate movie. But it's a touch and go. I don't know. Hey.
Okay, so you've got B movie, Mr. Magoo and Enchanted. They're the kind of... Clearly, the festive offerings, such as they are, and they're all better than Fred Claus, would be my guess.
Yeah.
Each
absolutely.
One of them.
And they're all better than Youth Without Youth. Francis Ford Coppola returns to directing after... You say Coppola, I say Coppola, whichever one we feel like today.
Ford Coppola.
Yeah, fine. Well, so he's not directed anything for... last film he made, 97, was The Rainmaker, which was stinky bad. John Grisham novel, Your Friend. And the one he made before that was... He was on Radio 1. You interviewed him and you said, I love your books. You're really brilliant. Can I come and live with you? You did. No, you did interview him.
Making it all up, Mark.
Fine. The one he made before that was Jack, in which Robin Williams was a child who grows four times at normal speed, so he becomes a grown-up even when he's a child, which enables him to go and buy adult magazines for his other child friends. And that really bothered me. I didn't get that at all, but it was dedicated to Gio, and there was a very personal thing about it because Francis Ford Coppola suffered a loss in his family, and he kind of went, okay, fine, it's obviously a very personal project and it means a lot to you, and it's about a life lived fast. Now this new one, Youth Without Youth, is clearly a very personal project too. Tim Roth is a brilliant professor, stop laughing at the back, who's 80 something, and at the beginning of the movie he gets struck.
He's 80 something.
Yeah. A lot of slap on. At the beginning of the movie he gets struck by lightning, and he comes out of the having been struck by lightning and set on fire to by the lightning, comes out of the bandages to discover that in fact he's getting younger. The lightning has magically transformed him into somebody who is young. Now Francis Ford Coppola, as you probably know, has been trying for ages to get this Megalopolis thing off the ground, and it's not happening, and of course he's not getting any younger. And so people are saying, oh, it's a very personal film. It's about a life, in which you have an unfulfilled project, because Tim Roth's character is trying to get this great big magnum opus academic work finished, but he's running out of time, but then he gets struck by lightning, so maybe he has got time, so maybe there's a whole personal thing going on here. Anyway, here is a clip that gives you a sense of the madness of Youth Without Youth.
I understand that you are willing to speak to me candidly. You don't have to make a great effort. The words you cannot pronounce, you can write.
My name is Dominique Mate. On January the 8th, I reached the age of 70.
I am a teacher at Pietra Nemz.
I live on Strada Episcopiae at number 18. It is my house. It contains a library of some 8,000 volumes. which I have willed the lease.
You're 70 years old. Extraordinary.
Now, from here, things go a bit mad, right? Firstly, Tim Roth starts getting younger. Then he splits into two people. He can't decide whether he wants to carry on with his work, but he keeps being distracted by a woman who wants to, you know, be racy with him, wearing a suspender belt that's got a swastika on it. He then meets up with somebody else who's been involved in an accident, which has enabled them to speak Sanskrit. And it turns out that, in fact, all language is unravelling backwards in them. So they are therefore becoming an extraordinary project, which ends up with the birth of language, which is somehow complements his work. But on the other hand, he's being distracted by the fleshy delights of the thing. I
does
refer you to
number 23 come into it anyway? Previous.
No, it doesn't, but if it did and Jim Carrey came in, it really wouldn't seem at all out of place. I mean, here's what happened with watching the movie. Firstly, I started watching it, I fell asleep. I mean, as we know, this is not completely, and then you wake up a little bit, and then there's the bit with the woman in the suspender belt with the swastika on it, and I start thinking, I wonder what happened to Tinto Brass. Did Salon Kitty get passed uncut? Did Ilse Schewolf of the SS ever get through the BBFC? What about The Last Orgy of the Gestapo? I wonder whether any of those
supposed to know those movies you're referring
well,
to.
Well, I mean, if you're my age and you went through the video nasty scare, they are thinking. But then you wander back into the movie and Tim Roth is two people and the woman's babbling in Sanskrit and the camera moves aren't happening at all. And the whole thing's filmed in Romania. And some of the cast are from there and some of them from Bucharest, but they're obviously speaking in a second language and most large sections of them are overdubbed. And then you sort of zone out a little bit again and then you come back in again and the film's still going on and all language is unravelling in this strangely demonic possession kind of way. And you're thinking, this is pretty much unreleasably bad. I mean, the only possible reason for having any interest in this movie is that Francis Ford Coppola is back in the saddle and has apparently got another two on the go. Well, whoop-dee-doo on the basis of this. It's just...
What, follow-ons from this?
No, well, they may be thematically connected. But it's like one of those things where people have written things about it. It was very personal, very personal, very personal project. Yeah, you know what? It's very personal. Keep it in your house. Put it in a shed. You know, and there's a lot of things that are personal. I don't want them out in public. I certainly don't want to be somebody who was once a great filmmaker, I mean an unreliably great filmmaker given, but a great filmmaker, reduced to this sort of babbling nonsense. And this is how personal it is. He financed it all himself with proceeds from his vineyards. You know, he's an award-winning, what's the word for a vineyarder? Vineyardiste. No, that sounds
like... Winemaker.
No, a winemaker is somebody who makes wine.
Yes.
Somebody who owns the vineyards.
A grape keeper.
A grape keeper.
Well, it might be.
Yeah, it's like beekeeping, is it? A grape keeper. Right. Anyway, so that's what he's made. So he's put his own money into this. And it's clearly something that, from his point of view, in his time of life, has massive relevance and is all about the unfulfilled project and is all about the tension between, you know, the mind and the body, and it's got some politics in it. And he's just thinking, this is babbling garbage. I mean, it's so badly acted and so badly put together, and the dialogue is leaden when you can understand it. And if anybody else had made this movie, it would be coming straight out on DVD in a sort of double pack with some other piece of unreleasable Euro piffle. But as it is, it's Francis Ford Coppola, and so consequently we are all being told it's for our consideration for the awards period. You know what? I've considered it. My answer is, Francis, go back to the wine. This is so bad.
On that subject, Peter Allen, who is up in 40 seconds, assures me on a message it's a vintner.
A vintner. There we go.
Grapekeeper works for me.
That's because you do.
What was it you wanted to say about It's a Wonderful Life?
That it's not a film about sentimentality. It's a film about suicide, despair and existential angst with a very, very brief bit of sentimentality at the end, but it does demonstrate that all life is ultimately worth living because it only takes for decent people to be decent for the world to be a worthwhile place.
Movie of the week.
Well, by some distance, Enchanted.
Excellent.
Why are you looking so baffled?
I was just wondering where the music was. I thought,
they're letting us go on. We've got, he's chipped in with Vintner, that's it. We're done.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.